of showers and thunderstorms to the state from tonight through tomorrow, Wednesday, and into Wednesday night. High temperatures today will range from the low 70s in northern Indiana to the upper 80s in western Missouri. Lows tonight will drop into the 50s and 60s across the Midwest. The forecast for east central Illinois this afternoon, sunny with a high of 76. The wind out of the east from 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms after midnight. The low 57 and an east wind around 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms, the high 76, and the wind from the southeast at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, showers and thunderstorms are likely. The low will be in the low 60s. The wind from the southeast at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Wednesday, mostly cloudy with another chance of showers and thunderstorms. The high will be in the mid 70s. Wednesday night and Thursday, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. Look for a low in the low 60s Wednesday night and a high Thursday in the upper 70s. At noon central time, temperatures across Illinois and Indiana were in the upper 60s to the mid 70s. Most locations reporting sunshine. At Rockford, 70 degrees. O'Hare, 68. At Bloomington, 73. Mattoon, 72. And Carbondale, 75. At South Bend, Lafayette, and Indianapolis, 71 degrees. Terre Haute checked in with 73. And at noon, Willard Airport reported 73 degrees, a sunny sky. The dew point, 53. The relative humidity, 49%. The wind out of the northeast at 12. The barometric pressure, 30.11 and falling. And at 12:39, 74 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. Scientists continue to work on heart disease. One approach uses stem cells, cells that can, in theory, be coaxed into replacing heart cells damaged or destroyed by heart disease. NPR's Joe Palca has an update on the field known as regenerative medicine.
Regenerating functioning heart cells has been a goal of medicine for more than a century. University of Washington scientists Michael LaFlamme and Charles Murray put it this way. To achieve that goal, they write, the heart has been stabbed, snipped, contused, cauterized, coagulated, frozen, injected with toxins, infected, and infarcted in species ranging from marine invertebrates to horses. You don't often get that kind of lovely writing in the journal Nature. So has any of that stuff worked? Well, kinda. In mice, it's possible to find stem cells that will turn into functioning, beating heart cells. And those cells do go where they're needed, replacing cells that have been damaged. But the repairs are mostly modest, and as you may know, mice aren't humans. Their hearts are much smaller, and they beat much faster. What works in mice could flop in people. There are creatures that can regenerate heart tissue without any help from smarty-pants human scientists. The zebrafish is one example. You can cut out 20% of a zebrafish's heart, and the heart will grow back to normal. Obviously, human hearts can't do that. But scientists now do believe that there are stem cells that regenerate human hearts. They just do it at a glacial pace, not nearly fast enough to make repairs in the event of injury. Scientists are trying to identify these cardiac stem cells and then figure out how to juice them up so they can repair damage caused by a heart attack. Scientists are also trying to use a cocktail of chemicals to trick other kinds of stem cells that don't normally make heart cells to take on that role. But like mechanical pumps and artificial hearts, stem cell therapy is a high-tech, high-expense solution for dealing with heart diseases. Rather than wait for the day when medicine can replace or repair your damaged ticker, the painful truth is that today, heart health is largely in your hands. Eat sensibly, quit smoking, get some exercise, all that boring stuff. Not nearly as newsworthy as the latest medical breakthrough, but probably more relevant to your health. Joe Palca, NPR News.
The state of Kansas just did away with its arts agency, the first state in the country to do so. The arts community is up in arms. Others say there are good arguments for government getting out of arts funding. Other states are heading in the same direction as Kansas. With more on the story, here's NPR's Elizabeth Blair.
Kansas. Now, there's a state where arts organizations are not happy. Governor Sam Brownback recently gutted the Kansas Arts Commission, laid off its staff, and closed its doors. He says he wants to see the private sector pick up the slack.
I believe this will be a more successful way for us to move forward. We'll be able to leverage and raise private dollars.
Private dollars have been really good for the Topeka Civic Theater and Academy, where Shannon Riley is artistic director. The company is celebrating its 75th year.
And through most of that history, we've been funded solely through ticket revenue, donors, and corporate support.
Riley says for the most part, they have avoided government grants, and that has worked to their advantage.
More and more of the arts organizations that I was aware of that were receiving tax dollars were constantly under fire about their program and what they were doing. I liked being responsible to my donors and to the people who were invested in what we were doing more than a larger tax base.
Texas, New Hampshire, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, all over, state arts councils are facing deep budget cuts. Sometimes the bickering over government funding for the arts sounds like a broken record. Arts advocates say the arts are good for local economies. Politicians say taxpayers can't afford to subsidize ballerinas and basket weavers. Lawrence Reed, an economist with the Foundation for Economic Education, is one who believes the government should not fund the arts.
Arts are simply too important to be dependent upon the government.
Reed thinks it makes arts groups jump through too many hoops.
When you're dependent even partially upon government funding, you always run the risk of being buffeted by changing political winds.
The political storm over federal funding for the arts in the 1990s forced some people to find private alternatives. Ruby Lerner is executive director of Creative Capital, an arts funding organization launched in 1999 by a small group that wanted to find a new model for support.
I say we're small but mighty.
Lerner says with an annual fund of about $1.2 million, they take a venture capital approach. Unlike most government grants, creative capital donors treat artists like investments.
Because if you think you're going to benefit for future generations of artists based on the success of everything you support, then you're going to work really hard to help those projects become successful.
As for the return on investment, Lerner admits that so far it's been pretty small, if you're measuring it in dollars and cents. And for many arts advocates, that's the fear, that if left to the private sector, programs that aren't flashy will disappear. Shannon Riley is disappointed that Governor Brownback eliminated the Kansas Arts Commission, even though his theater company in Topeka didn't depend on it.
In a lot of places, the Kansas Art Commission provided the only monies available for any arts education whatsoever for kids. I love that, and I am terrified that that's not going to continue now.
Meantime, Governor Brownback named someone to lead the efforts to raise funds from the private sector. In an interview, that new appointee said she doesn't think it will be that hard, since the Kansas Arts Commission's budget was so small to begin with. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. It's 12:45. They're back, and if they're out in your neighborhood, they're hard to miss. I'm talking about the periodical cicadas. In the past few weeks, they've emerged by the billions in states from Maryland to Georgia to Oklahoma. In the first of two reports, Veronique LaCapra takes us out to the St. Louis suburbs to learn more about these insects.
It's a muggy afternoon in late May at the Kirkwood Farmers Market.
My name is Veronique. I'm doing a story on the cicadas. Do you have a minute to talk to me?
I love cicadas.
You love cicadas. May I talk to him?
10-year-old Matt Covington loves cicadas.
I just like holding them and putting them on the trees and stuff.
Yeah? What do they feel like?
They tickle when they draw on you. That's fun.
Oh my gosh, they look like little devils, and I don't like it.
19-year-old Lauren Pierce loves them. Well, not so much.
I think they're stinking up my neighborhood. They're rotting everywhere and they smell bad and they're really loud in some places and it's kind of a nuisance.
They are definitely really loud. Those are the males singing to attract mates. Chris Hartley, an entomologist at the Sophia M. Sachs Butterfly House in Chesterfield, says they make that sound by vibrating an organ on the side of their thorax called a timbal.
Now, a timbal works a lot like the freshness seal that you get on top of a bottle of juice, the things that you click in and out and they're... Well, they said they vibrate it really quickly, and they actually use the wings to amplify and resonate the sound out, which is part of what makes it so loud.
But these periodical cicadas have spent the past 13 years not making any noise at all. They've been underground, feeding on the juices of tree roots as small brown juveniles or nymphs.
The nymphs are these strange kind of alien-looking things that have no wings, very rudimentary legs that are only good for crawling and nothing else. And they kind of have these huge claw-like front legs.
When they're ready to emerge, the nymphs tunnel their way to the soil surface in the middle of the night, leaving visible holes in the ground about a half inch in diameter. They climb up the nearest bush or tree and molt for the last time, littering the foliage with their old brown casings. When the adult cicadas first emerge in the darkness, they're soft, pale white, and very vulnerable. It takes a couple of hours for their exoskeleton to darken and their wings to unfold and dry to a translucent orange gold. The red-eyed adults are a little over an inch long and live for 3 to 4 weeks.
A female will lay throughout her lifespan about 600 eggs.
Glenn Fry helps take care of the live insect collection at the St. Louis Zoo. He says female cicadas use a sword-like organ called an ovipositor to slice into small tree branches and insert their eggs. When the ant-sized nymphs hatch 6 to 10 weeks later, they drop to the ground, dig a burrow, and start the 13-year cycle all over again. The egg-bearing twigs often turn brown, droop, and die. But Fry says cicadas aren't locusts. They don't eat leaves or attack crops.
They're causing some minor damage, but overall, even with the massive numbers of them, they're not going to do enough to kill a healthy full-grown tree. Young saplings may get enough damage where it could kill them just because they're not old enough. But for the most part, a healthy, older tree is going to do just fine.
Fry says the number of adult periodical cicadas has already peaked in our area, and we can expect this year's cohort to die off in the next couple weeks. I'm Veronique LaCapra.
Tomorrow, Veronique will have more on cicadas. We'll find out who eats them, and what they taste like.
From Noam Chomsky to Michael Copps, each week on Media Matters, Bob McChesney and his guests discuss the role and responsibility of media in our society. Join Bob for a two-hour Media Matters special, June 19th from 1 to 3, and pledge your financial support to the free and open discussion of ideas, Sunday, June 19th at 1.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 13th of June, 2011. It's the birthday in 1865 in Dublin of William Butler Yeats. It's the birthday of Dorothy L. Sayers, born in Oxford, 1893. She was one of the first women to graduate from Oxford with a degree in medieval literature. Her first two books were volumes of poetry, then her first mystery novel, Whose Body, 1923, featuring Lord Peter Wimsey, a witty aristocrat